Osama bin Laden's greatest fear was not capture or death, but the exposure of al-Qaeda's secrets. At great risk to themselves and the entire mission, the U.S. Special Operations Forces, who carried out the Abbottabad raid that killed bin Laden, took an additional 18 minutes to collect bin Laden's hard drives and thereby expose al-Qaeda's secrets. In the new book, The Bin Laden Papers, Nelly LaHood dives into bin Laden's files and distills the nearly 6,000 pages of Arabic private communications. For the first time, al-Qaeda's closely guarded secrets are laid bare. Nelly LaHood is a senior fellow in New America's International Security Program. The new book is The Bin Laden Papers, and we welcome Nelly LaHood to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for your interest in the book, Joe. Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
What brought you to this particular project, the story ultimately of al-Qaeda from 9/11 to the death of Osama bin Laden?
Correct. I have a bit of a history with some of these documents, and it all started back in 2012 when I was working at the CTC, the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. At the time, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence declassified the first batch of documents, about 17 files through our center. And I was the lead author on the study that accompanied these documents release. Now, the same office subsequently declassified documents on its own website, but in November 2017, the CIA declassified everything that's going to declassify, thousands of files, a massive volume consisting of text files, audio and video files. And, you know, given my interest earlier on in the early documents, I decided that I was going to investigate these files. And after clicking on thousands of files, I determined that the text files were the most important because the CIA didn't really categorize things. So with the help of two research assistants, we systematically went through all the text files, nearly 97,000 files. Most of them turned out to be newspaper articles and other materials that are publicly available, but they also comprised al-Qaeda's internal communications, nearly 6,000 Arabic pages. Now, by that, I mean documents and letters that were not meant for public consumption. In other words, they were al-Qaeda's closely guarded secrets.
I assume it's probably impossible to answer this question, but is there a key to understanding their communication style / practices that became evident while looking through these documents?
Well, in terms of the writing, it's their writings. It was, you know, once you immerse yourself in the letters, you get the hang of it. But to be clear, they were writing because they were not writing for public consumption. Sometimes their letters were, written in haste, and so that makes, you know, they're different from their polished public statements. So one really has to immerse oneself in the papers. And though it was an ambitious task to study 6,000 Arabic pages, it was somewhat easier than having to do them in as a teamwork, because you can only appreciate what's happening in the letters if you have read everything, because in some instances you find that you need to connect the dots between several letters in order to make sense of what was happening. And to be clear, sometimes I was able to decipher what was happening. Sometimes I was, some aspects defeated me, but Overall, I was able to chronicle al-Qaeda's history post 9/11, the major key events. We have a pretty solid idea now of what happened.
Two major threads to this that I would like to talk to you about during our time together. One is how bin Laden communicated with his associates. It's interesting because you talk in the book and you show us the planning, the ideas about possible attacks, the hostility they have, especially for Iran and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. Give us a sense of bin Laden and that communication with the people who were doing his work and he was associating with.
So let me give you a little bit of context of what was happening in Abbottabad, where bin Laden was hiding with his family. He went to great lengths to hide from the Pakistani authorities and from, of course, the CIA. And the bin Laden family was confined to the compound and adopted stringent security measures to evade the authorities, including that they didn't have any internet or telephone. And that is why we actually have the letters. Everything, all the communications between bin Laden and his top associates who were hiding in North Waziristan was through electronic letters that were saved on SIM cards and delivered through a network of couriers. So that's why we actually have these communications. We are so fortunate to have them for two reasons. The first has to do with the fact, and it's the obvious one, the heroism of the SEALs team who carried out the raid. And there's a rich story to this. The raid was supposed to be completed within 30 minutes. Mm. And Admiral McRaven, who oversaw the raid, he wanted it to be completed within 30 minutes because he had done some studies in the past, had studied several special operations missions, and concluded that time was of the essence. And in order for such missions to be successful, they needed to be completed within 30 minutes. Any delay equates with vulnerability. And so as the mission was underway, the SEALs, after having killed bin Laden, they called for extra time precisely because they found tons of computers and electronic gear on one of the top floors, and Admiral McRaven gave them the go-ahead to collect these materials, and he was kind enough to let me know that it was about 18 minutes. Now, the other reason why we are fortunate to have this is because these letters were supposed to be destroyed. Bin Laden should not have kept them. And we know this because about a month before the raid, one of his top associates in North Waziristan sends bin Laden a 12-page letter, at the end of which there's a PS, a remark. You know, I destroyed all the SIM cards on which we've been corresponding. This is a gentle reminder for you to do the same. So they were not supposed to, we're not supposed to have these communications. There was a great deal of stringent security measures in place in order to maintain the secrecy on those communications.
You write in the book that after 9/11, global jihad was on autopilot. How so?
You know, for a very long time, we thought that it was reported in the media and as well as to intelligence reports that Al-Qaeda was in command of global jihad. And the picture that emerges couldn't be more different. Mm. We learned from the letters that bin Laden had to disappear out of necessity, probably around November 2011. That was in the wake of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. And for about 3 years, he cut off communications with his associates. When he reconnected, they apprised him of what had happened to Al-Qaeda. And he found out in 2004 that Al-Qaeda itself was shattered. The letters speak of afflictions, aimlessness, and so on. And Al-Qaeda didn't regain its operational capabilities. And though bin Laden continued his desire to launch international terrorism, particularly against the United States, we find him, itching for more international terrorism throughout the letters. But at the same time, we find his associates having to remind him repeatedly that they don't have the wherewithal to mount international attacks. Not only did the war devastate Al-Qaeda, the drone campaign as well ensured that Al-Qaeda kept, everybody in Al-Qaeda had to be in hiding in North Waziristan.
Nellie LaHood is our guest. The name of the new book is The Bin Laden Papers. It is published by Yale University Press. I was asking you earlier about the relationship with his associates, and from what you just said, and in reading the book, you certainly get this idea of here is a man that was very much in defeat. He is also, as you say, itching to get back onto the global stage, but he's so at odds with the new militant groups that are emerging.
Absolutely. I mean, to put this in context, in 2004, when he reconnected with his associates, he found Al-Qaeda to be shattered. And the only good news that his associates gave to him was that in one letter, it said, they wrote, when God knew of our afflictions, he opened the door of jihad for us in Iraq. They were referring to the Iraq war and to the rise of Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi in Iraq. Now, in 2004, this seemed the war in Iraq and Zarqawi in Iraq seemed like a lifeline for Al-Qaeda. And when Zarqawi asked to merge with Al-Qaeda in 2004, this pleased bin Laden very, very much. The hope was that Zarqawi would unite jihadi militants in Iraq under one umbrella, and it would all act in unison, if you like, against the occupying forces. Now, Zarqawi failed to unite the militant groups in Iraq and instead focused his attacks against the Shia, now including their marketplace, attacks on civilians in the marketplace and in mosques and so on. Now, that's not what Al-Qaeda signed up for. They gave Zarqawi the brand of Al-Qaeda because they wanted Al-Qaeda to be in the news for killing Americans and not Iraqis. So we find, that the Al-Qaeda's leaders urging him to minimize his attacks in Iraq and spending a good deal of their time writing letters, mediating between jihadi groups in Iraq. Now, the problem was not just in Iraq. There was a rise of other militant groups. All of them wanted to have the Al-Qaeda brand. And we find, except for one of them, the North African group, which is the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, practically all the other groups that were acting in the name of Al-Qaeda were a headache for bin Laden and his associates, mainly because they were focused on attacking the local regimes when, in fact, bin Laden wanted them to attack the United States and focus on global jihad through attacking the United States. And we find him by 2010 and 2011 explicitly noting in his letters that they had become a liability to global jihad. And in one letter, he says that the Muslim public is repulsed by their attacks.
So let us go back a little bit from 2011 following 9/11, which is attacks such as the Madrid bombing in 2004, the July 2005 attack on the London transit system. These were attacks that you write in the book, as well as plots to use explosives on flights dating to 2006. You say, quote, it's inconceivable that Al-Qaeda had the wherewithal to mount international attacks, which I think would surprise many people reading these papers.
Sure. I mean, you know, when the Madrid bombing occurred in 2004, a few months later, we have these letters reaching bin Laden in September 2004, talking about Al-Qaeda's afflictions, aimlessness. So not only were there no references to operational planning for the Madrid attacks, but they were talking about how devastated they were. There were also no references in the letters about carrying out the 2005 or the attempted plot in 2006 and many of the other attacks that were attributed to Al-Qaeda. So it is, and yes, it is inconceivable. And sure, some might say, well, maybe these were not recovered. Well, perhaps, and I know that there were some letters that were not recovered. Having said that, when we find in the letters that were composed in 2006, 2007, 2008, all the way up to 2011, the bin Laden's associates having to console him that, you know, true, we haven't been able to mount international attacks, but the enemy are terrorized and spending much money on their security. You can really deduce from this that they were not behind these attacks. And we find bin Laden by 2010 making it, warning his associates in a letter in 2010, noting that unless Al-Qaeda changes its strategy, it's going to come to an end as an organization. So, and we also find him complaining about the people who were heading the international terrorism unit in Al-Qaeda. We find references to them being incompetent. Many references repeatedly in the letters seem to suggest that Al-Qaeda did not have the wherewithal to carry out international terrorism, particularly attacks that were attributed to Al-Qaeda. So, for instance, to give you one example about the CIA officers that were killed in late 2009 by a jihadi who blew himself up. And this was an attack that was attributed to Al-Qaeda. And we find bin Laden and his associates writing in the letters that they learned about it in the news. So there were many other militant actors who were operating on the jihadi landscape. And of course, they were threatening, but Al-Qaeda itself, sometimes it would cheer some attacks, sometimes it would complain about some attacks in its public statements, but cheering and is very different from being capable of carrying out the attacks themselves.
With that said, you write that he did grow fixated on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 and was looking to, as you say, he wanted to attack the income of every American citizen, directly affecting the security and economy of the American people as a whole. The idea was a plot to blow up U.S. oil tankers in hopes of putting America into a severe economic crisis. That was not to be because of, prior to the anniversary, bin Laden, the SEAL team stormed bin Laden's compound. But what do you make of that plot and it actually being something that, for the reasons you just mentioned, that could have been realized?
Sure. This was, you know, this follows on from his desire to relaunch international terrorism. As I said earlier, he thought Al-Qaeda was going to come to an end, and he warned his associates that they needed to change their strategy. And the new strategy that he called it, to use his words, a balance of terror with the United States. And as you noted, he wanted to destroy 30% of the American economy. And he had done his homework. At the time, in 2010, the United States was still reliant on importing oil. So he wanted to sink the largest oil tankers. And there's a limited number of these vessels in the world, about 700 of them, 730 or so. And each one of them carries up to 2.2 million barrels of crude oil. And he wanted to have these simultaneous attacks targeting shipping routes that were headed towards the United States. And he also, because he had done his homework, it would be good, he thought, to sink them if they were carrying crude oil. But even if they were empty, he still wanted to sink them because it would take years to rebuild these oil tankers. Now, I didn't take his word for it because he put all these highly detailed and methodical plans. He thought of everything, the surveillance methods the operatives should follow, the type of wooden boat that they should purchase, the volume of explosives they should have. You get the picture. So I consulted a friend from the U.S. Navy, Commander Kurt Albo, who indicated to me that judging by the details, that Bin Laden had done his homework. And what he anticipated, Bin Laden anticipated that they would have enormous impact on the income of all Americans. And so in response, the American people would take to the streets. They would replicate the Vietnam anti-war protest and would force their governments to withdraw from the Middle East. Now, the idea for him was that, and this was actually the same objective that he had behind, that drove the 9/11 attacks. But by 2010, he realized that the 9/11 attacks, though he continued to refer to them as the victories, they didn't deliver what he termed a decisive blow, and he assumed that sinking oil tankers would. That was the objective that he had in mind. Now, thankfully, you know, the SEALs raided the compound, and more importantly, I suspect because of the documents that were recovered from the compound, the operative who was in charge of carrying out these attacks was apprehended sometimes, I think, in July, maybe in August, July or August in 2011.
So let us end here, and that is with a question. We only have a minute or two left. It's a big question, but let me try it with you, which is what we learn from these papers, what we learn from these archives. Is it possible that the United States can avoid making miscalculations again from what we read in the papers of Osama bin Laden?
I hope so. I think, you know, practitioners and people in the military are better placed than me to answer these questions. I do think, though, I have to say, because of the security measures that bin Laden took in terms of the communications within Al-Qaeda's top echelon, it is understandable that it was difficult to assess Al-Qaeda's capabilities because it was impossible to penetrate their communications. But it is also the case, and I don't want to be, you know, I think we can afford to be a little bit more critical in terms of Al-Qaeda's role in global jihad. Some of these informations between Al-Qaeda's top associates and regional jihadi groups, their communications were done through email, encrypted emails, and it was very clear even to bin Laden that these communications were intercepted. So I think the distorted picture that was reported about Al-Qaeda's role in global jihad post 9/11 was misassessed by intelligence agencies. And on that front, I hope that we could learn in the future about some of these miscalculations.
Nellie LaHood is the author of the new book, The Bin Laden Papers, How the Abbottabad Raid Revealed the Truth About Al-Qaeda, Its Leader, and His Family. The book is published by Yale University Press. Nellie, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Bin Laden Papers. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.